Councillor Lake, the Mayor, Julie, Sean, and fellow citizens. What a wonderful thing to come down from Sydney and to find such a large audience waiting for me. I had no idea that there would be so many, and it proves once again that Melbourne's a serious place. Melbourne likes to come out, think about issues. It's why Melbourne and Victoria was the first to get into the issues of federation, and why Melbourne has always been the first in serious matters about the future of our country and about issues of civic morality and engagement with each other as Australians. Now, this week for me is the big Monash week, because yesterday at the Windsor Hotel, I attended the meeting of the Rotary Club of Melbourne, of which Sir John Monash was one of the founders and the second president, and I received for the fifth in succession, I received the Monash Medal, a very beautiful plaque with the face of Sir John Monash on it, and I'm very proud to walk in the footsteps of very distinguished Melburnians. The first was Sir Gustav Nossal. He got the first one 5 years ago, and I got this one. I think I'm the first New South Wales person that has been allowed to have the Monash Medal, and so I regard myself especially privileged to have received it. Then tonight, in the city of Monash, is this 14th lecture, which I'm equally proud to be invited to give. And tomorrow morning, on the 8th of the 8th, I will be going at 8 o'clock in the morning to the Shrine of Remembrance, where there will be a remembrance of the Battle of Amiens, which was the battle in the First World War where Monash really displayed his great generalship. And so on each of the days, I've had an encounter with Monash. A number of questions have been given to school children who come in quite large numbers to the Shrine of Remembrance about what they know about Monash and what they think about Monash. And the answers come back that they don't know very much about him and that they don't think very much about him. And for that reason, it's appropriate that we should take the opportunity just to reflect for a few minutes on what an extraordinary person he was. I mean, after all said and done, can you name another university in the whole world that was named after a person whose chief claim to international fame was as a general? It's not common to name a university or place of learning after such a person, but Monash was a very, very unusual general, and he was a general who commanded tremendous admiration, so that when he died in 1931, the funeral was the largest funeral that had ever been held, a public state funeral in Australia to that time. So let us think on Monash. Monash, a boy of parents who came out to Victoria, Australia, from Prussia. The first spelling of his name was M-O-N-A-S-C-H in the Germanic manner. But it was simplified when he got to Victoria, to the name we all know. He came from a village in Prussia where one of the neighbouring families was named Ludendorff. And Erich Ludendorff was later to be the commander of the German armies in the First World War that he, Monash, had to defeat. And when on the 8th of the 8th, 1918, under Monash's brilliant planning, the Allied forces for the first time obtained a sustained breakthrough on the Western Front. All that mud and all those trenches and all those dead soldiers on both sides, for virtually the whole length of the war, it was the very detailed planning of Monash that helped the Allies, helped the British Army there with a large contingent from the UK, a large contingent from Canada, and a large contingent from Australians, and 50,000 inexperienced American troops who'd just arrived. It was on the 8th of the 8th, 18, that the battle for Hommel, which was one of the towns around Amiens, was successful, and Monash's strategy was not to continue with the strategy which had been transfixed the British up to that time of just sending thousands and hundreds of thousands against machine guns, a very ignoble sort of war, a very unequal struggle to send flesh against machine guns. Monash brought into play a tripartite strategy of technology. He brought into play the new tanks and the very new aircraft and the mobilization of manpower in reserve so that it only came in after the air warfare and the tanks had made the path safe. Unlike most of the British generals of the First World War, he regarded every life of his soldiers as precious. And he was a soldier who hated war. He was a person who had suffered discrimination in his lifetime. Discrimination first because he had come from Prussia. And a lot of people who were his professional rivals and enemies spoke adversely to him because we were fighting the Germans and there was a great hatred of the Germans. Even the royal family changed their name from Saxe-Coburg-Gotha to Windsor. Such was the hatred. And the Battenbergs became the Mountbattens. There was such hatred of the Germans that everything had to be, anything that was German was very suspect. Actually, if you go to the war memorial in Adelaide, where there had been for nearly 70 years a large German community, just look at the names on that war memorial of the people who were sent over there to fight Germany, and they're all German, virtually all German names. So they were fighting for the King Emperor against the Kaiser and König Wilhelm der Zweite, the second William. And so it was loyal Australians, but Monash was regarded with suspicion. The second reason he was regarded with suspicion and discriminated against was because he was Jewish. And there was a great deal of anti-Semitism directed at Monash. Anti-Semitism hadn't been very strong in Australia, but a number of people jumped on the bandwagon and attacked Monash because he was a German Jew. And they opposed his promotion in the ranks, saying he's just got there because, like so many Semitic people, he's very good at pushing himself forward. Very anti-Semitic attitudes towards him. Billy Hughes, the Australian Prime Minister in the latter part of the war, was urged to remove Monash, and Sir Keith Murdoch, the father of Rupert Murdoch, and the grandfather of all the other Murdochs, was conducting a campaign against Monash on the basis that he was a pushy German Jew who had worked his way up by his pushiness, not by his ability. And to his great credit, Billy Hughes, he might have been a bit deaf, but he wasn't without a few marbles, and he decided he'd go over there to the front and see for himself. And he spoke to the military who were under Monash, and he decided that this was rubbish and he was not going to remove Monash, and he had every confidence in him. And so great was the victory on the 8th of the 8th that King George the 5th came over to the Western Front on the 12th of the 8th, that's just 4 days later, and in the field of battle he knighted General Monash and created him Sir John Monash. And that was the first time that a British monarch had knighted a soldier in the field of battle since 1743. So it was a very rare thing. It's very hard for us to get our heads into the circumstances, but if you just imagine they're in the middle of this war, Gallipoli, a brilliant strategy to get behind the Germans and help Russia and open the double front, a brilliant strategy which was very poorly executed and which failed. Australia must be the only country in the world that celebrates a mighty battle where we failed. If you go to the Dardanelles, as I have done with my partner, and you just stay there, you can see the circumstances of Gallipoli. And Monash was in Gallipoli, but that was a big failure. And Monash then went to the Western Front, and then the further he moved up in the ranks, the further he was able to bring his own talent and skill and his own special way of doing things, which involved intense study of the circumstances before he committed a single life to warfare. But there was a third reason why Monash was discriminated against. His wife had a disability, and he formed a relationship with a very nice person named Lizzie. A bit like Alexandra, the Queen and Empress to Edward VII, who on Edward VII's deathbed invited Mrs. Keppel, Edward VII's long-term partner, to come to Buckingham Palace to be with the king as he died. And they both sat around this man as he died. A real act of kindness. Monash never denied his partner Lizzie. And that was very shocking in the circumstances of the 1920s. Here was this brilliant general with an unusual personal relationship. And his family knew about this, and his family yesterday, his great-grandson, at the Rotary Club said, "Yes, we all knew about this. So what?" And they were not perplexed. But Sir John Monash was a very unusual man for his time. He stood up for his partner and wouldn't renounce her. But King George the Fifth wouldn't have them at Buckingham Palace. They were the mood. That was the temperature of the time. Anyway, this is an amazing week. This is the very week, a century ago, this very week that the First World War started. It started, well, you can take different dates, but the German Imperial Force declared war on France on the 3rd of August, and it declared war on Belgium on the 4th of August, and it declared war on His Britannic Majesty on the 6th of August, yesterday. Yesterday was the first event, the sinking of a large British battle cruiser with 150 Royal Navy sailors lost. That was the first British loss of the war. But it was go on to enormous losses, but under Monash, they were minimised. He was an amazing, brilliant, remarkable Australian. He then came back, as you know, after the war, and he he became a very important civic leader. He established the SECV, and he was engaged in many civic activities, including Rotary International when it was first established in Australia. So it's important for us to know these things and to put ourselves into the times 100 years ago this week and 100 years ago when he planned and executed the brilliantly successful battle for Hommel and for Amiens, when he broke through the lines. Ludendorff said, "This is the blackest day of the German army," and the Germans knew that the war was lost. And within 100 days, the whole thing was over with the armistice. So Monash was a very important Australian general. Bernard Montgomery, a great general in the Second World War, said that of all the generals of the First World War, he would name Sir John Monash as the greatest of them. And that is a professional peer speaking of our John Monash. So he's a worthy person to be remembered, and I'm very proud to have received his medal and to be asked to give this lecture and to be here in the city of Monash, welcomed by the mayor of the city of Monash, and with all of you people here tonight reflecting on this extraordinary Australian who didn't have it easy and who was discriminated against. And we should just reflect on that. Now, the mayor is a symbol of the fact that this is a democracy. And I now have reached a fork in my speech. And I have to go down one path or the other path. You can't have both. One path is to tell you about the work I've recently done on North Korea. It's a very unusual story. North Korea is, how will I put this, a very peculiar place. And a very wrong place that has for 60 years done terrible wrongs to its own citizens. And I was appointed last year to be chair of a commission of inquiry of the Human Rights Council of the United Nations of the world, produced a report, found many instances of crimes against humanity, and that is now waiting for consideration by the General Assembly of the United Nations and by the Security Council, the highest organ of the United Nations. So that is a very interesting speech, and I can give that to you now. On the other hand, I was in Melbourne just 2 weeks ago, immediately after the downing of MH17. And I was here for the big AIDS conference, which is the biggest conference that Australia has had. I think there were 15,000 people attending. There was a tremendous cloud over the conference because of the loss of so many people. But by reason of great leadership of Melbourne scientists and civil society and politicians, we got it back on the road, and we addressed issues of discrimination and injustice and inequality in Australia and overseas as they are relevant to the great global struggle against HIV and AIDS. And Melbourne did us proud. I don't think it would have been as well handled in Sydney. For example, now this was a very... I don't want to be divisive here, but I know you'll agree at least with much of this. But at the opening plenary, where I had to give a speech at the opening, the president of the International AIDS Society, Sharon Lewin, who is a professor of Monash and works with the Burnett Institute and is about to become the executive director of the Peter Doherty Institute, they brought up onto the stage all of the presidents of the International AIDS Society, and that was appropriate because one of the people who was lost on MH17 was Joep Lange, a Netherlands scientist of great ability, with his partner, and he had been a president of the International AIDS Society. So all of the presidents who were there were on the stage. Very proper. But in an act that I thought was inspired, was sensitive and very Melbourne, they also brought the entire delegation from the Netherlands onto the stage. My partner is from the Netherlands. The Netherlands had just done so well in the World Cup. They were so uplifted by it. And then they lost 200 and more of their citizens in MH17. And just having them on the stage, weeping as they came up, it was like a catharsis. I don't think there were many dry tears in the audience. And it was a very serious and lovely step to take. And I think it was the reason why we were then able to put it behind us and get on with the subject of the conference as Joep Lange would have expected. And so that's a very interesting story too. We will now have a vote. You can't vote twice. And I'm watching this, and that's a very serious electoral fraud. And I mean, I can always come back if I'm invited. No, but we've got to get this show on the road. We don't have all night. I've been given 40 minutes, and 40 minutes is what I've got to give you. So, those who want a talk on the human rights violations of North Korea, which no one else in the world can give you, put up your hand. Oh, thank you. Those who want a talk on diversity and the suffering of HIV and the steps forward that we had at the AIDS conference will now put up their hand. Oh, Mayor, you've got to invite me back. But tonight, we're going to have North Korea because that was a majority and we observed a majority, and it is a very interesting story. Now, this is what happened. For years, reports were coming into the United Nations about terrible abuses of human rights in North Korea. And the United Nations Human Rights Council therefore appointed a special rapporteur. This is a sort of missionary of the Secretary General to investigate human rights. North Korea would not let the special rapporteur, Professor Vittit Muntarbhorn of Thailand, into their country. Subsequently, he was replaced by Mr. Marzuki Darusman, the Attorney General of Indonesia, who still holds the office. And he was not allowed into North Korea. As well as that, North Korea was obliged under the rules of the United Nations to undergo what's called Universal Periodic Review. Every country now gets examined for its human rights record. We in Australia get examined, and we get very severely criticised in relation to our conduct in respect of Aboriginals, and in respect of refugees, and in respect of other matters. But North Korea was also criticised during its investigation, and it had 189 suggestions for important changes it had to make to bring itself into conformity with the United Nations Human Rights Standard, and it didn't accept a single one. It remains the only country which has undergone universal periodic review that has not accepted a single recommendation for improvement of its human rights standard. It asserted, you don't understand, this is our system which was created by the great leader Kim Il-sung, our country is perfect, we have nothing to learn from you, and we will not do anything that you suggest. And so the Human Rights Council had a motion before it to create a commission of inquiry. This is ratcheting up the seriousness with which the United Nations is addressing the issue. And I was appointed to be the chair of that by the president of the Human Rights Council, who is the Polish ambassador to the Human Rights Council. And two other participants were added to the Commission of Inquiry. One was Mr. Durisman, the special rapporteur, and the other was Sonja Biserko, who is an expert from Serbia on crimes against humanity and genocide, with which Serbia has had quite a lot of experience. And so we three were appointed. We met for the first time. First of all, I should say to you that the resolution to establish the commission was carried on the voices. There was no call for a vote. That was the first time a commission of inquiry by the United Nations has been set up without a vote, because usually it's very hotly contested. But that also shows how the international community was getting fed up with North Korea and determined that something should be done to investigate carefully the matters of human rights. The mandate we received from the Human Rights Council had nine headings. They ranged from the secret detention camps, which we found contained between 100,000 and 120,000 people, often of the third generation. They would put the whole family in if they were thought to be enemies of the regime. The issue of inability to move in the country. To leave your village, you need the approval of a local official. The inability to get access to information. You can't have access to the internet. There's no access to independent news. Your television stations and radios are fixed on the government stations. You can't, it's a very serious offence to be found with soap operas from South Korea, because the soap operas in their background show what a prosperous country is south of the border, and how many people, how well people live in comparison to North Korea, which they're constantly told by their propaganda is the most successful economy in the region. And so other issues related to famine and to the fact that 27% of babies are born severely stunted. Even now, there was a great famine in the 1990s, but even today, many people in North Korea are very severely malnourished and many die of starvation. Investigating the right to food and the deprivation of the right to food by a country which, whilst the famine was on, instead of spending the money on feeding its population, which is the first obligation of any government anywhere at any time, they were spending their money on developing a nuclear arsenal with 20 nuclear warheads, a missile system that would deliver those weapons outside North Korea to Japan, to China, and to South Korea. In addition, they were spending money on sustaining the fourth largest standing army in the world. And so this highly armed country, which resolves political disputes, such as the one that arose between the supreme leader, Kim Jong-un, and his uncle by marriage, Jang Song-taek, the uncle of the supreme leader, You remember he was hauled out of a meeting of the Politburo. He was immediately taken to a military tribunal. He was accused of treason. The judges in the military tribunal were reported in the North Korea media as screaming and shouting at him and denouncing him as less than a dog. And he was convicted and executed by a firing squad, all within a space of 4 days. That was the way they resolved the political dispute between the supreme leader and a man who until that week had been the second or third most powerful person in the land. And so far as we can gather, his sin was he suggested that North Korea should keep its political system but should go down the path of China and open up its economy and become more like China, whose prosperity can be seen by the citizens of North Korea across the rivers in the northeast, northwest of the country. Another issue was the suppression of religion and discrimination against women, discrimination against people on the ground of their caste, their social rank, and abduction of nationals. They would send agents disguised as fishermen into Japan, where they would seize people, including young children, on their way home from school, and take them to North Korea for reasons of the state, including such reasons as in order to give us training in the latest idiom of the Japanese language so that our agents in Japan will not be mistaken for aliens. We investigated all of these matters, but we couldn't get into North Korea. We never expected to get into North Korea. If they wouldn't cooperate with the Human Rights Council or with the Special Rapporteur, they weren't going to cooperate with us. But it wasn't difficult to get evidence. We were able to get the evidence from in the first instance, from 26,000 refugees who have fled North Korea and are living in South Korea. So there's a tremendous pool of witnesses, and they began to come forward in very large numbers. In the end, we had to cut it off because we had to write our report effectively in little more than 6 months. But we decided that in order to combat the strategy, now this was Sir John Monash at work, we were trying to think very strategically about how we could overcome what would inevitably be the criticism, because you couldn't get in, you can't really report what goes on there. And we thought the way we can counter that was by having public hearings. The commissions of inquiry of the United Nations generally happen in private, secret. But we thought that the British way of doing it, to have public hearings and to have witnesses before international media and to have audio and video recordings of what people were saying, so long as we were sure that it would be safe for them to give their testimony in public. And we would then put that up on the web. Now, that would not be available in North Korea because, as I've told you, North Korea doesn't allow access to the internet to its citizens. But it would be available to the whole world, including in China, and it would counteract the suggestion which North Korea immediately put out, that these were human scum who were self-selected enemies of the people of North Korea and of its brave social experiment, therefore not to be trusted. This also was the response eventually of China to the report. If you could not persuade the country concerned to permit you access to their territory, then your report is flawed because you could not get into that territory. This was an unacceptable response, and it was rejected by the member states of the Human Rights Council because effectively it would give North Korea a veto over any investigation of its human rights record, which is not how the Charter of the United Nations operates. We delivered our report to the Human Rights Council in March of this year. it was, well, it created something of a sensation because there'd never been a report which had been prepared so transparently. We had our public hearings in Seoul, in Tokyo, in London, where there's a big North Korean community, and in Washington, D.C. and Bangkok. All of this was done openly, and that was something entirely new. The Secretary General of the United Nations, when I delivered the report to him, said to me, "You told me that you would do this commission in a different way." Well, you certainly did. I think that was a sort of John Monash moment. Maybe Aussies are good at doing things in a peculiar way. But anyway, the only countries that voted against the report in the Human Rights Council were six of 45. China, the Russian Federation, Vietnam, Venezuela, Cuba, and Pakistan. They were the six. But the other countries overwhelmingly supported what the Commission of Inquiry had recommended, including the recommendation that the case of North Korea, given the findings that there were reasonable cause to accept grave crimes against humanity had been done, and that North Korea's case should be referred to the International Criminal Court for investigation. Now the crunch time is approaching. The report will go from the Human Rights Council with this very strong endorsement to the General Assembly in September. It will probably then be referred into the Security Council in October. And the real question will be, will the Security Council act on the report which we have delivered as we have recommended? Many people say to me, given the vote against the report, which the Russian Federation and the People's Republic of China participated in voting against, how can you expect that the Security Council, where those two nations have a veto, how can you expect that you will get action by the Security Council on the report? Well, I must say to you that watching very closely, as I did, the action over the last 2 weeks in the Security Council over MH17, that rather encouraged me to think, in a matter which is of the highest strategic importance to the Russian Federation, that it was possible to work out a response which was at least a partly effective response, partly because the international community had demonstrated by very strong action that it was deeply concerned and deeply insistent on an effective response to the MH17. And what we have to hope is that some of the same resolution, efficiency and strength that we've seen in the last fortnight on the part, including on the part of the Australian government, which I must say acted admirably in its role as a member of the Security Council this year. If we can get a similar strong response to the report that talks not of a terrible tragedy for 300 people, but a dreadful calamity that has been lasting for 70 years for 23 million people who live in North Korea, for at least a million people who starved in the 1990s famine, and for 120,000 people who are detained in the detention camps and effectively starved there, and who have suffered terrible wrongs of discrimination and of autocracy in a totalitarian regime, the like of which does not exist anywhere else in the world. So it's a matter of, this is breaking news, I've told you exactly where we are, but I'm not pessimistic. I believe that the international community has acted in this case exactly as it should act. And the most moving moments for me were at the end of the deliberations of the Human Rights Council. We, the three commissioners, were surrounded by the ambassadors from the former Soviet bloc, the ambassador of the Czech Republic, the ambassador of Albania, the ambassador of Kazakhstan. They all came up to us and they said, in effect, thank you for your report. We know what you're talking about. We have had similar things done to us. It wasn't as bad as you have described it in your report, but we know where you're coming from. Never think that the report that you have produced has been futile if there isn't immediate action. Because what you have done is to record the position of human rights in North Korea, and therefore part of the record and history of the Korean people at this moment. And when in due course the cloud of the human rights violations lifts from the people of North Korea, they will at least know that the United Nations did everything it should. It created a commission of inquiry. It appointed three very independent people. They came unanimously to their conclusion. The conclusion was then acted upon, and it went through the steps. And if, for the moment, there is an impediment because of the veto, then those who take that step will have to bear the judgment of the international community and the judgment of history. But eventually, there will be action, and the action will be based on the recommendations of this report of the United Nations, which for once has acted impeccably and as was intended in the great language of the Charter of 1945, which I first read at the North Strathfield Public School when I was about 9 years of age. And it's still in my mind. We, the peoples of the United Nations, determined to avoid the scourge of war, which twice in our generations has inflicted untold cruelty upon humanity, established these United Nations, and we do so on three great principles: universal peace and security, universal human rights, and justice for all nations and peoples. And it's those three principles which we have tried in our report to reflect, and I'm hoping that without too much delay, it will be brought to bear in North Korea. So that is what we agreed. You voted, you got it. And okay, we've now got a few minutes for some Q&A. I'm getting used to Q&A, and it's time for a few questions. Are there any questions? Does anybody have, or a comment? You don't have to agree with anything I said. I'm not an authority figure anymore. Yes, just a moment. I'm going to come down. I'm going to come and do my Jerry Springer act.